History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And if we don't want them to go untold, we need to take the initiative to ask a few questions. And more importantly, to listen patiently to what comes back our way. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, we always come out ahead because not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but we really are inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. This weekend marks the 77th anniversary of the longest day, D-Day, in the invasion of Normandy. And we're going to share one way in which this D-Day anniversary is different from every previous anniversary because of a resource available for the very first time that can help us put faces and histories on the severe cost exacted on those beaches in France. But before we get to that, we're going to hear memories of that longest day from a couple men who were there that day, participating in Operation Overlord, which would become the largest amphibious invasion in military history. More than 156,000 American, Canadian, and British troops, employing nearly 7,000 ships and landing craft, more than 3,000 aircraft, which included more than 800 gliders, which of course were on one-way missions behind enemy lines. Much like the Battle of Midway, which was unfolding 79 years ago this week in the Pacific, the invasion of Normandy would become a huge turning point in the war, and significant contributions were made by the more than 13,000 paratroopers who jumped into darkness and uncertainty that day. You would be hard-pressed to find anyone who's done more to pay tribute to his fellow paratroopers than 99-year-old Tom Rice of Coronado, California. He's going to hit the century mark in August. Last weekend, he participated in a special Memorial Day ceremony in his hometown. But so many times in the last decade, he has jumped out of an airplane again to bring attention to what his fellow airborne veterans did on June 6, 1944. Tom's personal memories of that mission, his first combat jump with the 101st Airborne Division's 501st Parachute Infantry Regiment, are as detailed as they come. And I think you'll be able to see how easily he could have been added to that number of more than 2,500 Americans killed on that first day of the invasion.
There were 11 airdromes in and about England where the paratroopers were gathering. Mm-hmm. And they would be taking off at different times, forming a wedge of 45 aircraft. Now, this mass armada is going to be 10 miles long. It's going to be at least 2 miles wide. The Pathfinders are going to take, I believe, 57 minutes to get to their drop zones. The paratroopers are coming in at 60-some minutes. And then the next morning, gliders in 76 minutes. I think it's just about a kind of a guesswork on that schedule. So we had trained hard. We were isolated. No contact with anybody on the outside. Some of the guys had English girlfriends. Could not make contact with them. No connection with the civilian population whatsoever. There was guards all around this assembly area. On the evening of June 5, we met early evening, and we went to our aircraft. We had 6 parapacks slung underneath the aircraft. Each one weighed 300 pounds and had all of our equipment, probably machine gun, tripod, and ammunition, and maybe a bundle full of K-rations or TNT or whatever it may be. Mm-hmm. 6 parapacks underneath. Each one weighed 300 pounds. We rolled those, packed them, and rolled them, and attached them to the aircraft, and then practiced a drop so that things going to work.
Mm-hmm. Is that just a lever that releases them or something?
Yeah, number two man behind, I jumped number one. Mm-hmm. Number two man had a switch. That would drop the 6 parapacks simultaneously. If that failed, number three man had a lever, and he would pull that lever, mechanical operation there. That would drop the 6 parapacks. So we had double check on that.
Mm-hmm. So you load onto this C-47?
The C-47 DC-3.
Mm-hmm.
I jumped number one, last one to get in the plane, so I was number one seat there. It's the shape of an arrow, And we were parked on the side, what do we call part of that arrow. Each plane would swing down and then take off. If any plane had a problem, there would be a mess.
Yeah.
And one of the planes taking off, there was a fella in the plane who fired his rifle into his foot. Evidently, he freaked out.
Mm-hmm.
The officer went over and grabbed him, lifted him up, banged him up against the bulkhead of the aircraft just as it was moving down the runway, not going very fast, took him to the door and threw him out.
Wow.
This guy bounced a little bit, and then the medis picked him up. And then an inquiry occurred later after we came back from Normandy and completely exonerated the officer. That's what he should have done. We never knew who this fellow was. That was kept quiet.
Wow.
We know who the officer was.
Right.
That was
right.
Good. But anyway, here we are on the takeoff field. Planes were taking off, one right after another, one every 10 seconds. I mean, when that plane revved up, it sounded like every rivet was going to come apart. You know, I mean, there was noise. I went forward, sat down on the lower deck, and leaned against the cockpit door and told the pilot that if there's any problem that relates to us, let me know. I'll fall back and wake up. So I stayed in that position most of the time until the officer in charge, Lieutenant Jansen, told me to get up there to number one. You know, above the door, there's three lights.
Mm-hmm.
There's a red, a white, and a green one. The Pathfinders are already in. Some of them missed the drop zone. Some of them didn't. Some of them were spread so far apart that it's unbelievable. We got the worst drop in the entire 13,200.
Out of the whole D-Day operation.
On the whole D-Day operation, yeah.
Why? What happened? Where were you dropped?
When we took off at 10:41, English double summertime, we flew at 5,000 feet. We assembled in groups of 45 each. That was called a section.
Mm-hmm.
I was in section 14, third from the lead plane on the right. I'm jumping number one. We dropped down to 1,500 feet after the section had organized itself. Now, we were about 100 feet wingtip to wingtip, real close, tight formation. We flew past Jersey and Guernsey Island. In the water was a small submarine that emitted a signal to show that we were on the right track for the pilots to follow. And then we got to another signal beyond Jersey and Guernsey Island, and that point we turned left. Now, if you can visualize the Cottonton Peninsula on the left and the Brittany Peninsula on the right, this was a neat scheme because the Germans didn't know whether we're going to go right or we're going to go left.
Mm-hmm.
So we turned left. I'm at the door getting things organized and following instructions. I looked out and I saw low tide. I saw the community of Brownsville, and I could see the pattern of rivers that ran into the channel there. White light is on. Red and green are off.
Mm-hmm.
When we hit Brownsville, the red light goes on, means we got 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody was stand up and hook up. We're all standing up. We're holding on to the steel cable that runs, 3/8 inch steel cable that runs right through the center. Mm-hmm. We have to hook up our webbing to that with an anchor line snap fastener in our left hand and make sure it faces the right way. Got it faced the wrong way, could be in trouble. So stand up and hook up. It was verbal signals and mechanical signals so that everybody understood. A red light was on. We were checking. We ran into fog. Now we're less than 100 feet apart.
Mm-hmm.
The lead plane had a blue light on the dome, and it was at a little lower altitude. The others were staggered up a little bit so the pilots could see the blue light. When that blue light goes on, that means that they got that lead plane got the signal from the Pathfinders, and they crossed the T, and they snapped on the green light. Everybody snaps their green lights on. So we jump at that point. Ran into fog. I was looking out the door, and I could see just almost a rectangular area that was just filled with tracers. There were yellow, there were red, there were green, and white. It looked like the 4th of July, you know. Nothing bursting like that, but tracers coming up.
You guys have been spotted and the enemy's firing at you.
Yeah, well, we were heading into that.
Oh, this is ahead of you. You can tell that this
is what we're going to have to go through.
The artillery fire is already happening.
It's already happening. We're going to have to go through this. Mm-hmm. So they avoided it, and I dare say the pilot may have panicked a little here, because there was an investigation afterwards. We swung off to the right. All of Company C swung off to the right because we had 9 planes. Mm-hmm. Our company commander ended 20 miles from our drop zone. We didn't get together for a whole week. We were spread all over the place. We were originally, as I understood it, to jump on drop zone B. They found out that drop zone B was underwater. So it was fortunate that when they broke the pattern of flight, we were over the edge of D. And I went out over the edge of D. The only thing that bothered me is that I was going to get castrated because the machine gun bullets were on the left wing and they might come through the floor of the plane, you know. Mm.
So as you're jumping, your plane's getting hit.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. You could hear it on the wing.
Wow.
And now our gas tanks are not self-sealing. And the pilot is yawing and pitching. We're going up and down to avoid penetration with shells, you know, mm-hmm. and bullets, whatnot. Up and down. The guys were wobbling. The green light goes on. I jump. And just as I did, number one and number two men pull the switches. The plane goes up because the load was dropped.
Right.
And I went out the door at the same time. And when I turned the prop blast, we were going 165 miles an hour. Mm-hmm. We got a jump at 95 to 100. The jump master, lieutenant, called the pilot and said, slow the thing down. We can't jump. Now, the pilot's yawing and pitching, whatnot. Mm-hmm. He ignored it. So when I went out, we were yawing and pitching, and the plane went up 50 feet. The parapax dropped. The prop blast hit me and threw me up against the side of the aircraft.
Wow.
My left arm got caught in the lower left-hand corner of the door. So I swung out, my helmet came down over my face, my reserve parachute was forced up to my face because the musette bag was underneath, so I didn't know what the dickens was going on. 2.8 seconds transpired, nothing should have opened by that time. So I swung in and hit the aircraft side again, swung out, got the helmet up, and I saw the parapax cover of the parachute flapping under the rudder of the airplane. So number two and number three man got loose, got out. Mm-hmm. So when I swung back in, I turned a little bit and I got free.
I can't imagine what that feels like. You talk about disaster here. This is your moment, your first experience in the war, really, in what's going to be a combat situation. You almost didn't get away from the plane.
Get away from it, yeah.
And you would have died.
Yeah.
So if you couldn't free yourself, probably.
I had a Hamilton wristwatch, a gold Hamilton wristwatch. It cost me $150, and that was stripped right off of my arm. My arm was black and blue from the armpit down to the wrist.
Ooh.
And I didn't know it until 3 weeks later and taking some clothes off. We didn't take any clothes off, you know. I have to guess at the altitude. I'll make a conservative guess. I jumped from 500 feet to 400 feet. 750.
Uh-huh.
So I was on the ground pronto.
That must have been a pretty rough landing.
Oh, yeah. It was a hard landing.
So what'd you come down in? What kind of terrain?
It was grassy area that was more pasture than anything, and then a small ditch that was, about 6 feet deep, full of water, smelly, dirty water. And so here I am on my back. I can't get my harness off because the musette bag, the reserve parachute, a Mae West, and a quick release. Now, the quick release had a toadstool type thing on it, and when you arm it, a red dot shows, and then you hit it like that, and it springs out.
Mm-hmm.
You probably know about that thing.
Right.
Okay, whatever they want to call it. I couldn't get at that thing. I had a double zipper up here under my chin with a switchblade knife, so I unzipped that. And incidentally, I had the cricket under there. You know about the cricket?
Tell everybody about the cricket.
Yeah, okay. So just mention that so you're on track with me.
The cricket's going to come in handy later.
Yeah, maybe.
In theory.
Yeah.
Okay.
In theory, yeah.
Yeah.
So the cricket and the jump knife are in the same pocket, right? Double zippered right under my chin.
Uh-huh.
So I unzipped that. The cricket fell out. I lost it and didn't know it. I got the double-bladed knife out and start cutting the risers. I got halfway through one riser, and number two and three man came up. They had the mortar. Evidently, they had found one of the bundles and got the mortar. So that means time has gone by here for a little bit. So we crossed the canal, and Frank Ficarota, one of the guys on the carrying the mortar parts, went into the canal. We had to dig him out. He came out smelling like you can't believe, yelling and screaming. And this is supposed to be a quiet situation, you know.
So, yeah, it's dark. Yeah, it's the middle of the night. Dark. You're supposed to be surprising the enemy.
So we got him quiet, and we worked our way over to a decomposed granite road. I heard some footsteps maybe 150 yards away on decomposed granite. So I got him quiet, did the click. One of the guys did the click. The miner's lost. And they got a click back.
And that's what, when you mentioned the cricket earlier, some people are saying, what, he's carrying little bugs around? No, this was a device that would allow you to communicate with others without drawing too much attention.
That's right. And no identification, you see.
What does it sound like?
Click, click, mm-hmm. like that. Mm-hmm. You just didn't hold one click. You went click, click.
Right.
And the answer would be double click, 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 click. Then we would work toward each other, clicking continually.
Right.
We got within safe distance. Then we'd use the password. Mm-hmm. So let's say you're in the airborne and you're one of my friends, and we clicked successfully. And I'm not sure about you. It could be a German enemy that has one of these things.
Yeah.
So I go with the password, flash. You would then recognize that flash. Uh-huh. Possibly I'm an American.
Right.
I don't know still about you. You come back with thunder.
Mm-hmm.
Then that puts me at ease that you possibly are an American. Now, to cinch it from flash, thunder, then I'd say welcome. And a German trying to pronounce welcome, the W is a V, welcome, you see. You'd pick that up real quick. Mm-hmm. Then we'd meet, get up and hug each other and find out who we are. And he's probably somebody from the 82nd Airborne.
And you're doing all this, which you've never done before, not in this situation, in the dark, with an arm that almost got ripped off, a back that's probably all bruised up from
probably,
the impact.
Yeah.
Were you feeling pain? Were you even conscious of that?
No. I mean, our focus was to do what we're supposed to do and get organized and group.
Mm-hmm.
Because we got objectives.
And did you have any idea where you were?
No. These guys were coming down the road. It must have been 8 or 10 of them coming down the road. And we clicked them and met them. And we stood up and kind of conversed. And one of them came to me and said, I've got a hand grenade with the pin pulled. You cannot put the pin back in a hand grenade. It's not possible because the bend is bent.
Right.
And he probably didn't have the pin anyway. So here he is with a hand grenade, squeezing it like almighty. And if you ever let loose of it, that spoon goes up. You know what the hand grenade is like.
Yeah.
And it fires the cap, and it goes down the train of powder, and then 5 seconds it goes. Oh, he said, I got a hand grenade with a pin pulled. I said, okay, give it to me. Had everybody get down. I got down and rolled over to the ditch, dropped it in the ditch, rolled back, and by the time I got to the middle of the road, the thing exploded, and I'm covered with water. So we went on down the road a little further. No enemy. What is this, the game we're playing here?
Hold on a second. Why did you want the hand grenade? Why did you put yourself in greater danger?
Because I was responsible for those guys, and they looked like I didn't recognize. Here's one of the things we tried to learn is the profile if we saw these guys at night and our maneuvers and their voice. I wasn't sure. There was a number of them, and I wasn't sure about their voices or their profiles, but I felt that things were friendly enough. I just took it on myself. I was a ranking guy there, even though I may not have been.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, I found out who the guy was that had a hand grenade, and he was a lieutenant, and I'm just a staff sergeant.
but your leadership qualities
there you go.
Rose to the occasion.
Yeah, right. I had to.
Yeah.
So.
Right, sorry for interrupting. I'm sure a lot of people are saying, wait, if that guy, that's his problem. That's not your problem.
So we broke up into groups. And went on down the road. I'm saying to these guys, nothing's happening here, but I saw a house on the side of the road about 50 yards back and said, we got to investigate this. So I set about 5 of them around to the back of the house, and Floyd Martin and me and another guy went to the front of the house. I said to Floyd Martin, don't bang on the door like an ugly American. Just knock, you know. He banged on it with his rifle, but you could hear it from probably 2 kilometers away. And after about 30 seconds or so, a Frenchman came to the door. Blasé as could be. Now, you wouldn't believe this. In a long, white nightgown from shoulder to floor.
Mm-hmm.
With a white tousled nightcap.
Wow.
With a dish with a candle in it lighted. Now, if you were in that situation, what would you think or say or do?
That's a good question. What'd you do?
I started to laugh.
I think I probably would have laughed.
I started to laugh like you can't believe. And the reason being, I suddenly recognized that's the Christmas Carol play, Charles Dickens' Christmas Carol.
Yeah.
I saw that. And it looked like...
It looked like Scrooge.
Yeah. Right. So he didn't respond to anything, so I just pushed him aside and went in. Three or four of the guys followed that were behind me. And I unloaded the map and put it on the floor and tried to get him to tell us where we were. He finally saw the word Carentan, and he pointed in that direction. His wife came out from another door dressed the same way.
Uh-huh.
That was no laugh. I didn't laugh at that one. After trying to talking with him and not frightening him, he said he'll want to be excused for a minute. So we did okay. So he went out and he got six rounds of ammunition. He gave us four and he kept two. And so we left right away. Assured him we're not going to do anything. So we wandered around there out in fields, and a horse was had been hit with shrapnel. A medic I had with me, Robert Schill, he patched him up with sulfadiazone, and we used the horse as a protection to get to some other point. Went into a house, searching the houses, and I crossed a window and I had a rifle shot come through for the sniper. It hit just in front of me and caught me in the leg. It was a hard, like I was hit like a baseball bat almost, you know. So I just pulled a pant leg up and pulled it out and put it in my pocket. I never know what happened to it after that.
So this is your first day.
Yeah.
And you're already hit.
First day. This is June 6th.
Mm-hmm. And you've already got a wound in your leg.
Yeah, I got a wound that I didn't pay too much attention to. It didn't bother me that much, crying out loud. I'm not going to medic and say, give me a Purple Heart or make a record of this baloney.
Tom Rice would be wounded more significantly 6 months later during the Battle of the Bulge. But all these years later, he still has not given up jumping out of airplanes. He's observing the 77th anniversary of D-Day this year aboard the USS Midway Museum in San Diego. But he will be jumping again for his 100th birthday in August. You can link to Tom's complete original interview at hometownheroesradio.com. And when we come back, a man who had to bury nearly 20% of the 2,500 Americans who were killed on June 6, 1944, those Gold Star heroes who now, 77 years later, have all been memorialized personally in one place. More on that effort as well when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. If you're a business owner, I've got a phone number you really ought to take down, 800-989-1139. And when I say business owner, I mean businesses of all shapes and sizes, from the multinational chain to the hot dog stand on the corner, or my personal preference, the taco truck, 800-989-1139. Because you can have the greatest product or service in the world, the best business plan, the most capable workforce, and still not maximize your potential if you don't have a reliable, efficient, and versatile plan for processing payments. 800-989-1139. That's the number for my friends at Provident Payments, one of the fastest growing payment consultants in the country. Why is Provident growing so fast? Because they're committed to helping your business grow. 800-989-1139. That nonprofit you love that relies on donations? Provident can even connect you to a special software platform to streamline and stimulate giving. If you are ready to grow, give it a go. Go Provident today at providentpayments.com or call that number, 800-989-1139.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Last night, when I spoke with you about the fall of Rome, I knew at that moment that troops of the United States and our allies were crossing the channel in another and greater operation. It has come to pass with success thus far. And so, in this poignant hour, I ask you to join with me in prayer. Almighty God, our sons, pride of our nation, this day have set upon a mighty endeavor, a struggle to preserve our republic, our religion, and our civilization, and to set free a suffering humanity. Lead them straight and true. Give strength to their arms, stoutness to their hearts, steadfastness in their faith. They will need thy blessings. Their road will be long and hard. For the enemy is strong. He may hurl back our forces. Success may not come with rushing speed, but we shall return again and again. And we know that by thy grace and by the righteousness of our cause, our sons will triumph.
That was President Franklin D. Roosevelt on June 6, 1944. You can link to his entire prayer at hometownheroesradio.com. And next year, on the 78th anniversary of D-Day, the nonprofit group Friends of the National World War II Memorial plans on unveiling a new addition to that memorial, a plaque capturing every word of FDR's D-Day prayer. When the president said, "Our sons," one of the men he was talking about was Vito Mastrangelo. The son of Italian immigrants, Vito lost his only brother, Bert, who died in India during the war, but Vito would also carry out one of the most sobering duties that any of those more than 150,000 Allied troops had to endure on the longest day.
We took off on June the 5th, got in the middle of the channel, had to return back. The weather was terrible, just terrible. So we spent the night there. Next morning we took off on June the 6th. I had one squad on that landing craft, and a few extra men that I didn't know who they were. So we got to the edge of Normandy, and we were just circling around. Finally, a destroyer came after us. He says, they need that bulldozer on the beach. So that's why I landed on the beach on June the 6th, early afternoon. Spent the night soaking wet. Every inch of my body was wet. And spent the night there on the beach in an old German trench.
Let me ask you, before you left, and you mentioned you guys took off June 5th, got halfway there, had to turn around because of the weather. But before you even left, was there anything that suggested to you or gave you any indication of what you were going to be getting into?
Not really. Not really. But as soon as you got on the beach, you knew what had happened.
And what was it that you were expecting you guys were going to do? Did you have an assignment or a duty that you were looking forward to that point?
At the time, I hate to talk about the early time there on the beach, but it was terrible. But it was a distraction to see a body on the beach, incoming troops. Those all had to be cleared out of the way with my little squad. I want to mention my company was 607th Graves Registration Company, 3rd Platoon. There's four platoons in the company. I was a third. We landed there early afternoon.
I want to make sure I'm hearing you correctly. So as you're heading over, and you've got these men that you described, and you told us they told you you needed to go in because they needed the bulldozer.
Uh-huh.
So you know, before you even step ashore, your job is going to be taking care of guys who've been killed already.
Yes. Yes.
How did you feel about that?
I didn't think too much of it.
Yeah.
It was a job. You had to do it. But all these memories do come back. And they did come back 50 years later.
Because you went back physically.
That's right. For 50 years, my folks didn't know what I did.
Mm.
I never did tell them.
Wow.
They never asked, so I didn't say nothing. And I think that's mostly GIs did the same thing. I don't think they talked about the war to their folks.
It's been my experience just in interviewing hundreds of vets that most of them will say exactly what you're saying.
Yeah.
And the reasons they usually give are, one, I didn't want to be bragging about it.
Yeah.
Two, which I'm guessing applies in your case, there were so many who didn't come home.
That's right.
Including your own brother and all those guys you buried over there.
Absolutely.
But from the get-go, your first experience of war is clearing away dead bodies so more troops can come ashore?
Especially on a beach.
You just had to move them out of the way?
You had to pick them up.
And then what do you do with them?
We would have a special place. We had tents, put them in the tank. You had to keep them away from the eyes of incoming troops.
So you didn't want the guys coming in to see how many had already been killed?
No, no.
Wow.
No.
So this is, in one way, logistical, to make sure there's space for troops to come ashore and vehicles. And maybe even more importantly, this is a psychological move that you don't want guys to be thinking, hey, that's going to happen to me.
That's right.
So from the time you hit the beach, that's what you're doing.
Yeah, my men were doing.
I'm just trying to imagine what that feels like, because you're...
And I was 20 years old.
Can 20 you years old.
20 years old. I had 25 men with me, and that's what we did. Later on, as the battle moved on, some of those men were ordered to all emergency hospitals. They would tour those every day and pick up who didn't survive the day before. Some of the sites you can't talk about, even to this day. War is hell. Some of the sites were terrible. The guy that shot, you know, it's terrible to see him. But there's situations that some of them had horrible deaths. Like I said, it's been over 70 years. It's still on my mind. Terrible situations I've seen. It bothers me to this day. Many nights. Well, last night I didn't fall asleep until midnight.
Because you're seeing images?
Oh yeah. All the time.
And this has been going on for 70 years.
Over 70 years. You never forget. You never forget. Especially, we lost 18 men on what they call a dry run a few weeks before in the English Channel. That was shut up for over 50 years.
This is Exercise Tiger you're talking about?
Right.
Yeah.
They were, 758 were killed by German PT boats that night, and 18 of our men were gone.
And you were there?
Luck of the draw again, 3rd platoon. We didn't go out that night, but the 4th went out that night.
Wow.
They got shot up. Just the luck of the draw.
And a lot of people still have never heard about that, but what you're saying, even though that happened before this invasion, the government kept it quiet.
Oh, yeah, for years.
And no one heard about it for decades.
For decades, that's correct.
But it was a big tragedy because here are the Allies practicing an invasion. The Germans show up and pick off hundreds of Allied troops.
That's correct.
And that would have been you if your platoon had been called.
Well, I knew some of those guys at the 4th platoon. Some of those guys, their wives were pregnant at the time. They would tell me. And those children never seen their dad.
And here you are, 20 years old, processing that.
Yeah.
And then you hit the beach at Normandy. And when you say things that you see over and over again, I don't want to make you share any details you're not comfortable with, but what you're talking about are the way some of these guys were killed, the conditions their bodies were in, and then I imagine just the magnitude of it, how many there were. Am I on the right track?
You're on the right track, right on. Yep.
Did you sleep that night?
No. You know, that first night on the beach, they said, okay, there's a German trench over there. Jump in that trench. You stay there all night long. It was an L-shaped trench. The leg of that L-shape followed the beach, and I was on the turn of the L. During the night, we got strafed. People that were lying in the beach. The next morning, I reached around the corner. I says, hey, how are you doing? I didn't hear a whisper from him. And when the sun came up, he was gone. Just arm's length from me. There again, the luck of the draw.
So German planes had come over at night and just strafed the beach.
Yeah.
And you heard it and saw it, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah.
And you knew it was coming close to you.
You hunker down and sure.
But it wasn't until the morning that you realized how close.
Yeah, that's right. Within 3 feet from me.
Wow.
Yeah.
Welcome to the war, Vito.
Yeah.
Holy smokes. And if that wasn't enough, tell us about what you had to do on June 7th.
June 7th. Well, we started a little temper cemetery right on the beach. And here comes a big old general. He says, we're not going to have a mass grave here because he's seen the bulldozer. It was a lot of sagebrush. We had to have that cleared off.
Right.
We had the troops dig in 6 feet down. Was he digging mostly sand there? But those bodies were moved later on in a week, at the end of the week, moved up the temporary cemetery that everybody saw on Private Ryan up on the bluff.
Right. But for that day, you probably spent that whole day overseeing the burial of hundreds of Americans right on the beach.
Right on the beach, 458.
458 dead Americans.
I got a picture of that. Somebody shot that picture a few days later, and somebody sent me that picture. It's in my files here.
Uh-huh. Were you just numb to it all, or did you feel the weight of that?
You have to. It'll drive you crazy. Drive you crazy. What for? What for? We would have wives come and visit the cemetery. They were in uniform. They'd cry out, they had a hard time to, oh my God, so much. That's why I was, like you said, you've heard it from someone else. They didn't talk about it. No, nobody talked about it.
What allowed you to start talking about it? And I know you've talked about it to school groups. You've made presentations.
When people wanted to know more information, you start opening up a little bit at a time. Mm-hmm. And that's where I'm at today. It's been over 70 years, and I have talked about it. People wanted to know. For instance, when I went back to one of the cemeteries, the guide there was a Belgian man. He was in the Belgian Air Force during the Second World War. He trained in Arizona, so he knew the English language quite well. He says, I want to show you something. We went to the office. He went into his private office for some paperwork or stuff. And there happened to be a book on that little table. And as I opened that book, I opened this page. And there's a picture of me. This was a staged burial. Myself was in there, and another fellow named Kistner, another Herbert. Kistner was from California. The other guy was from Illinois. They snapped that picture. And as he came out of the office, he started crying. I says, well, what's wrong? He says, the only reason that picture's in that book, because all the moms and dads that would come over here, they wanted to know if they were buried in just mud or something like that, or dirt or something like that. Well, I want to let you know that they were buried at that time in mattress covers. They were tied. It was a symbol that we had to do. We didn't want to do what that general said. We don't want no mass graves here. Mm-hmm. They weren't. So rest your mind, folks. They weren't. They were well taken care of. I know this day they're packed in ice and brought back. It's a different story now. But that at that time, there was no refrigeration for us.
So the best that you could do is get them in a mattress cover and get them in the ground. Did that mean something to you to hear him say
yes,
that photo,
yes,
just that photo,
yes,
provided comfort for families?
Absolutely.
That probably changed your perspective on what you did or why you did it.
That's right. I know I'm proud of what I did in the war. I know I talk a lot about the war stuff. A lot of people couldn't take it, but somebody had to do it. Everybody didn't fight with a rifle. There was mailmen, and there was cooks, and there was truck drivers, and I had a carbine over my shoulder all the time, mm-hmm, but I never fired it one time overseas.
But just my guess, and I've talked to guys who are in every combat situation you can imagine, I doubt very many of them would want to trade their spot with yours.
That's what I've heard from time and time again.
An unenviable job. I've got to ask you, you described June 7th, and temporarily burying 458 on the beach. At the time, you have no idea what June 6th is going to be,
that
we're going to be talking about it 70 years later.
Absolutely not.
But now with the benefit of history and knowing how pivotal that day was in the world, how should those 458 guys be remembered? What's the significance of their sacrifice?
Those people were the first ones to die in France. I still remember them and how they were taken care of. But I have really no solid way of describing my feelings, or do I want to?
And that was just the beginning for you. That's the day that gets the headlines.
And 80,000 later, the last guy that died. Yeah, my company of 125, total is about 80,000.
That's how many your company buried.
Yeah, and there was maybe 8 or 10 companies in Europe doing the same work. You know, I think I've said too much.
No.
No?
Never. But I am curious, knowing how painfully aware you are of the death that's happening, where you are and on the other side of the globe with your brother passing away. Were there ever times when you'd have one of these close calls where you thought, boy, somebody must be looking out for me?
Absolutely. You know what came to mind? I would say to myself, I'm too young to die. I just keep repeating, I'm too young to die. I haven't seen nothing yet. Those are the words that came to my mind all the time. Mm-hmm. I'm too young to die.
Vito Mastrangelo is now 97 years young. He was recently surprised with a special 97th birthday parade in front of his home in Visalia, California. And the stories of those 458 Americans he buried are now part of a collection we can all access on the 77th anniversary of D-Day. Every one of the 2,502 Americans who perished on June 6, 1944 is included. We're going to tell you how to find it and how it came about when Hometown Heroes Heroes comes right back after this.
Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328. When life throws you curveballs, you have to be adaptable, or at least have a good pinch hitter on the bench who knows how to handle a curve. When it comes to your business, Provident Payments is the best teammate you could ever have. Perhaps it helps that many of the leaders for one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America are former ballplayers. Contactless payments, online ordering, point of sale, you name it, Provident Payments knows it. Now, you could get some of these services from one of the big banking companies, but you're never going to get the kind of personalized service that Provident Payments delivers every day. 24/7 solution-based tech support. When your ability to process payments goes haywire in any way, time is money. So would you rather wait on hold for who knows how long, or would you like to have a direct line you can call for immediate help? That's where a good teammate comes in. Learn more about bringing Provident Payments onto your team at providentpayments.com. They really are one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. That website again, providentpayments.com.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, marking the 77th anniversary of D-Day and the invasion of Normandy. For the first time ever, you can go online and learn personal details about every one of the 2,502 Americans who gave their lives on the first day of that invasion. That's thanks to the effort of a group called Stories Behind the Stars. Go to storiesbehindthestars.org or link to it at hometownheroesradio.com to learn more about it. And the man behind it is Don Milne, who joins us now to tell us how this all came about.
Well, we didn't start with D-Day. My background was I was in the banking profession, and my kids are a little bit older. And so as a hobby, because I'm a World War II buff and a history buff, I just decided on my lunch break, I'm going to just write a story about someone who didn't come back from World War II. And I picked their 100th anniversary of when they were born. And I did that starting with the 75th anniversary of Pearl Harbor. My entire plan was to end at the 75th anniversary of the end of World War II, and that would have been September of 2020. But different things happened. It kind of blew out of what I was originally planning to be, and I ended up starting a project called Stories Behind the Stars, because one person can't write 400,000 stories, but if we have a couple thousand people, we can write 400,000 stories. So the whole mission of this nonprofit initiative is to write a story about every one of the U.S. World War II fallen that didn't come back from World War II. So it's just a brand new nonprofit initiative. How do we get started? So originally, because I was at that point living in Utah, and that's where most of my contacts were, I used the local media and some other methods to attract volunteers to say, hey, can you help me write the stories of the people that served in World War II from Utah that didn't make it home? And I came up with a list of 2,100. And over a six-month period, I was able to get about 120 people from Utah, but also like two dozen other states to pitch in with their time. And they would do some research online using Ancestry, Fold3, newspapers, unit histories to find the stories of these people just sitting at home, we were able to get those done. So that was pretty much done in January. And I thought, well, what can we do next? So I went to the National D-Day Memorial in Bedford and talked to them and said, can we get your list of everybody who died on D-Day? And they said, sure, here it is. There's 2,502 of them. And I went back to my growing number of volunteers. They said, can you help me out with this? Can we do the stories of all these Americans who didn't make it past midnight on June 6, 1944 on D-Day? And I was able to track 130 or so from 36 plus states, plus France and England. And they've been diligently working these since January. One individual's written like 250 of them by himself. And some people just do one or two. It's all volunteer. It's all what they can do on their own. But we can pretty fairly say that if someone served in the American Armed Forces, either in the airborne, the infantry, or at sea, there's a story available for anyone to read. So thanks to the volunteers that did that and a couple of women that managed the project for me on a day-to-day basis, that's been done.
Well, and I think it's important for people to hear that, because a lot of times we look at a project and we say, well, this is too big. It'll never happen. And I'm kind of reminded of what's happened with the Honor Flight Network in our country, where one man said, I'm going to fly one veteran to the World War II Memorial. And since this, over 100 cities across the country have flown thousands and thousands of veterans, all volunteers, all donations. And here you're doing the same thing, and you've already accomplished a big goal. So never before have we been able to go online and say, hey, I want to know who those Gold Star heroes from June 6, 1944, the longest day, are. And now I can pull up a picture and a story. And for folks who are saying, okay, how do I do this? Where do I go? Can you tell them what's the easiest way to dial up those stories on this 77th anniversary?
I think the easiest way would be just to go to storiesbehindthestars.org, and you'll see a link to our D-Day page. And we've highlighted like 12 stories that we finished early on that people could read. But you scroll a little bit farther down on that page, and you'll see a little box, and it says, find every D-Day fallen story here. So if they click onto that, it'll go onto another page that we're calling our Parade of Fallen page. Obviously, all these people who died on D-Day, they weren't ever part of these parades that our veterans were able to participate when they came back home. So I've kind of created a digital version of that, and you can scroll state by state. We picked one name from each state to kind of be the flag bearer, and you can read that person's individual story by clicking there. We've listed how many individuals from that state died on D-Day, and then we have a general link that you can click, and that will take you to where all of the stories for that particular state can be found. We teamed up with Ancestry.com for this project, and they provide our volunteers with free access to their research products, which is Ancestry.com, which is used for like genealogy records and census and some of the military records. But they also gave us free access to newspapers.com. So if there was something about this person when they were growing up, or maybe something in the paper after they were killed, anything about them that would have been a local paper, we may be able to find it there. And then Fold 3 is a military remembrance site that also has records, and we're able to use that. And that's where we're saving all these stories. Eventually, what our plan is, you won't have to go to a website to read these stories. You can go to any cemetery or any memorial where some of these World War II fallen are buried. Use your phone with the smartphone app that we're developing. Just scan the name off of the gravestone memorial, and then it'll immediately pull up that story from Fold 3. We want to make it super easy, and the stories aren't super long. Some of them are a little bit longer than others, because there are a few people here that, even though they were in their late teens, early 20s, they had quite a lot to talk about. So some of them stories do get a little bit longer, but we're basically looking for an obituary-length article that you can read and 2 to 5 minutes, because our primary audience, we think, is going to be at Arlington or at the Normandy Cemetery, or maybe somebody closer to home that their body was sent back home, and read their story there at their gravesite. And so right now, when the app is ready, obviously we won't be able to do it with the stories you have done, like the D-Day names are all done, but our goal will be eventually, with enough volunteers writing these stories, every person from World War II will have their stories done. And our app doesn't like have a cutoff that says, well, if they didn't die World War II, the app won't work. So as long as somebody has saved a story on Fold 3 from whatever conflict, whether they came home and lived another 50 years and died, it'll still work with those names too. So we think it's far time for the experience of visiting cemeteries on Memorial Days or elsewhere. Reflect that we live in the 21st century, not the 19th century.
Amen. And, you know, you talked about Memorial Day, and in a moment I'd love to get an example from you or two of one of those 2,500 D-Day Gold Star heroes who are now listed at storiesbehindthestars.org. But you mentioned Memorial Day, and I know you have some short-term and long-term goals with this project, and you just mentioned eventually all 406,000 Americans who died in World War II are going to be searchable here. But since Memorial Day, I mean, it hasn't been very long at all. What's the response been like as people have heard about this ongoing project? And how encouraging is it to see people step up to the plate and say, hey, I want to help with this too?
Well, coming into May, before we started getting some Memorial Day news coverage, either in the weeks up to Memorial Day or Memorial Day weekend, we just passed like 1,000 people. But now we're past, I just looked today, we had 1,241 people that are been interested in volunteering and helping out with our project. So we've had like 200 more people here in just the last month. And I haven't been able to reach out to most of them yet because I've been busy talking to people like you that are helping us spread the word out more. It's just really heartening to see there's so many people in America that have a love for our fallen that they want to see this done. And being a nonprofit, we don't have like a big budget. We can go out and spend lots of money to attract attention, but I don't think we need to because people that are interested in this will hear it from programs like yours and they'll contact us and say, how can I help? And basically all we're asking people to do is if you have a Netflix account, instead of on the weekend spending 2 hours watching a movie that after you watch, you're going to probably say, well, I could have used my time better than that. Take those same 2 hours, sit down at your computer. We'll give you a name and set you loose with the training that we give you. And within a couple hours, you'll have enough information that you can craft that 400,000 word story in most cases. It'll be a permanent record that we hope will be available for decades for anyone to remember that person. And that person no longer remains just a name carved on stone with some dates and maybe a few other very limited information. One of the things, though, we have to warn people is it can be pretty addicting once you get into it. I kind of ask people, we're only looking for you to do one story a week. How hard can that be instead of watching a TV show or maybe a golf around this week, just spend your time doing this. But I've got dozens and dozens of people that are doing this multiple names per day. And those people are obviously retired. I hope they're not doing it at work when they should be working. But it's very fulfilling and enriching, and it's something that people really enjoy, and it gives a lot of purpose, and they know they're contributing to something important.
And it gives a lot of perspective, too. And I've, you know, I'm thinking right now, a lot of our listeners are retired, and we're on radio stations all throughout California and in Oregon and Washington and New Mexico and Nevada. And I'm sure there are people in every one of those areas who are willing to jump in and do this. And we hear from people all over the world. And I know you have, too, with folks who are willing to help with this. So I hope some folks will respond at storiesbehindthestars.org. As far as D-Day, and there are so many elements of World War II who don't get enough attention. This is a day that for a long time has gotten attention. But isn't it incredible that 77 years later, there's something new that for the first time people can go online and search and get a story behind each one of those names who died on June 6, 1944. So can you give us an example or two, Don, of a story that you became familiar with that really kind of grabbed you and gave you that powerful perspective?
Yeah, I can share a couple. And these are ones I haven't written. So that's what one of the things I appreciate with having these 130-plus volunteers do these stories. I could never have done this on my own, and they've been sending me some of the ones that are kind of stand out to them. And this one, if I was to write a novel about World War II and I was to put this character in the novel and try to get it to my editor, he said, can you try to make something that's a little more realistic? Because I don't think all these things could have happened to just one person. But there was an individual from Massachusetts by the name of Joseph L. Tate, and his last name was actually Tattlebaum. He was born in Russia. So that's already kind of interesting. Here's someone who died in D-Day, who was born in Russia. But it gets even more intriguing than that. He's born in 1909. It was Russia at the time, but it would have been Poland today. And when he came to the United States, even though being first-generation immigrant, he got a law degree. He became a lawyer. And then when it came time for World War II to start, he decided instead of maybe applying to be an officer, obviously if you've got the education to be a lawyer, there'd be no reason why you wouldn't qualify as an officer. He decided to enroll as an enlisted man. So he was a corporal when he was serving at the end. He joined the 1st Infantry Division. That division was one of the first ones that fought in the European theater in World War II. So he would have been in North Africa. He would have been in Sicily. And then they pulled out to go back to England to get ready for the D-Day invasion. While he was there, he met a woman from India, and they got married. And then he was in the 1st Infantry Division in the unit that went onto Omaha Beach right at the start. And so he never made it past the first day. His wife was pregnant. They had a daughter. So isn't that quite a fascinating story that if someone were to visit his cemetery, he's at the American cemetery there in Normandy, and just see his name, Joseph Tate, they wouldn't know any of this. But it's so interesting that someone has such a rich story like that. And it's a little bit sad, too, that he's a lawyer. He could have accomplished quite a lot. A lot of lawyers go on to serve in public service. Could he have been maybe someone that became a representative or some other leader in his community there in Massachusetts? That was quite interesting. I'll just share one other one. There's a fellow by the name of John D. Halls. He was from Colorado. And a lot of people, their familiarity with D-Day may be because they watched Band of Brothers. So he was actually in the same regiment as Dick Winters, the main character in the Band of Brothers book and TV show. But he never made it past D-Day, obviously, or he wouldn't be part of this project. There's a famous scene in Band of Brothers where Dick Winters leads his unit to take Braycor Manor. There were some guns that were threatening the beaches that if they didn't take out could have killed a lot of men on Utah Beach. So this paratrooper by the name of John D. Halls was part of that unit that took out that set of four German guns. He was one of the ones that didn't make it. He was then Lieutenant Winters. He refers to PSC Halls in his remembrances of that battle. There was a lot of awards that were given out for that battle, and it's actually been taught, I guess, in some infantry training because of the way that they were able to do that. And here's one of the people that made it successful, but he died doing it. He didn't go on to become known as one of the Band of Brothers because he never made it past D-Day, but he played an important role. It's something that people will be able to find going forward because we've got this story that's been written now. He's also at the Normandy American Cemetery there in Normandy.
And I know there's so many different things we could touch on here, but as far as why this is so important, I know it's a given for you, and the proof is in the pudding with all the work that you've done on this. But for those out there who are saying, okay, this sounds unique, this sounds a little different, but why is this so important? And how long do you think it's going to take you to get all 406,000 names from World War II?
I think why it's important is specifically, why did we pick World War II and not World War I or Korea or something else? And I think it's the uniqueness of what America accomplished in our involvement in World War II. A lot of historians would probably, if you asked them, so what if America would have become neutral? Would Germany and Japan have won the war? Germany probably would have had a hard time overcoming Russia because it was so huge and they had so many resources and it would just been difficult to defeat. So there's a strong argument can be made that Russia eventually would have beaten Germany. And without the United States having landed on D-Day, there's a good argument that all of Europe could have ended up communist, which we know how bad the Nazi regime was, but in many respects, a lot of what happened with the communists wasn't much better. But because of America's involvement, we made it so at least Western Europe was free, and Germany became a thriving democracy. And in the Pacific, Japan was no longer this totalitarian dictatorship run by the military. It also became a free democracy. And unlike hardly any other nation in previous wars, we didn't go in and say, okay, we conquered you. You guys have to pay for it. We said, we won, but we want peace. And we think the best way for there to be peace is for you to create a democracy. And we think democratic countries will remain peaceful. And I think that's proved to be true. And it couldn't have happened if these 400,000 people had done that. So that's, I guess, the answer to that question with why I think it's important is because we need to recognize that America, the world, would not be where we are today if America hadn't played the role in World War II. And we were successful because these men and some women were there to pay the price to get us to the end successfully.
And as far as the end for your project, at least with regard to World War II, you have a target date set to reach the eye-popping and overwhelming number of 406,000?
Yeah, it's going to be, we think we can be done, our mission plan is to be done by September 2nd of 2025. That's the 80th anniversary of the end of World War II. There'll still be some World War II vets that are alive at that point, not as many as there are now, and they're losing more every day, but we can at least report to them that every one of their friends that many of them think about as often as daily will always be remembered because we have this project that we now have completed for all our World War II dead. It may sound like a lot, but it's pretty reasonable when you do some of the math. If we had 2,000 people helping with this project and they average just one story a week, that's all we need to get 400,000 plus. And we don't know quite the number is, but I have one individual that he's been doing some research in this area, and the number he uses is 421,000. There's about 10,000 from the Merchant Marines that sometimes don't get included, but we think we can get all those done in that time frame if we get that 2,000 or so people that are able to give up a couple hours a week to do this. And we don't think everyone that does this is going to sign up for the duration. It's not like you're drafted like they were in World War II, and once you're in the program, then you have to stay here till it's done. We get people that join and drop out. I had an individual from Florida that he did like 400 names in the last year, but he's recently told me that he's 78 years old and he's ready to do something else with his life. So that's great. It's great that he did 400 names, but I bet you there's some more other people that are going to step up and do the same thing he did. And even if you just do a dozen, that's every name gets us one name closer. I think a lot of people, they may have someone from their family that died, or maybe a friend of someone of their family that died. They can just start with that one name, and if that's all we do, that's great. But I think what will happen is we'll catch this bug that's caught so many of our volunteers, and they'll want to keep doing it just because it's so satisfying to do this on a regular basis.
Yeah, obviously, every single name counts, and what an impressive effort you've undertaken. And I know a lot of people who are listening right now are going to respond and be part of this. And I look forward to that day when it is complete and we can talk about that. And there will never be any more of these Gold Star heroes who fall through the cracks. So, Don, thank you so much for what you're doing. Godspeed as you continue that pursuit. Is there anything else you think our listeners need to know?
They just need to visit storiesbehindthestars.org. And there's a button right in the middle that they can give us their contact information, and we'll send them the details on how they can help. Like I said, there's no cost involved. If they don't already have the research tools, because of the generous help we have from Ancestry, we'll get them set up for free. So try it out.
Exactly. Try it out at storiesbehindthestars.org. I have that linked for you as well at hometownheroesradio.com. You never know how big a difference you might make or what you might learn along the way. Thanks again to Don Milne, as well as Tom Rice and Vito Mastrangelo, who both continue to do everything they can to honor those who paid the ultimate price for our freedom 77 years ago on the Normandy Peninsula. That's all the time we have today. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.